The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to join you here tonight to introduce our guest, Hamilton Nolan, a labor journalist who regularly contributes to In These Times magazine and The Guardian. Hamilton Nolan has written about inequality, politics, and class war for The New York Times, The Washington Post, Gawker, and Splinter, among other publications. He also regularly contributes articles about boxing to Defector. A member of the Writers Guild of America East, Hamilton led the 2015 effort to unionize Gawker Media, where he was the longest-serving writer in the organization's history. Tonight, he joins us with his book, The Hammer: Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor. In it, he offers a comprehensive overview of the contemporary labor, American labor movement, and highlights specific actions and organizations where politics and workers combine to affect change. Tonight's author will be joined in conversation with Kim Kelly. She has worked as a labor columnist for Teen Vogue since 2018, and her writing on labor, class, and politics has appeared in The New Republic, The Washington Post, The New York Times, and Esquire, among other places. Also a video correspondent for More Perfect Union, The Real News Network, and Means TV, she formerly served as the heavy metal editor at Vice's, RIP, Noisy Imprint. She was an original member of the Vice Union, is a member of the Industrial Workers of the World's Freelance Journalists Union, and is a member and elected councilperson for the Writers Guild of America East, Philadelphia. Please join me in welcoming tonight's guests.
I'm going to say, first of all, thank you to the Free Library of Philadelphia for having me. Thank you to everybody here for coming out. And thank you to Kim Kelly, my friend and union compadre, for doing this event with me.
Yeah, thank you for being here in Philadelphia, Hamilton.
Absolutely.
I'm excited every time you come down to visit, and it's great that I get to do this for his book, because I've dragged Hamilton down here at least two or three times when I was promoting my book. So it's really just payback is what we're doing up here. How many people have read the book already? All right, so you're going to get a hell of an introduction, I'll tell you that much. So, Hamilton, just in case not everyone is super familiar with your work already, could you tell us who you are?
I've been a journalist for about 20 years. I grew up in Florida. My parents were very kind of activist-type people, 60s people. My dad was a civil rights worker and later a communist in Atlanta. They worked on an underground newspaper in Atlanta. So I grew up sort of with that vibe in the house and always hearing about political issues and talking about that stuff and being interested in that stuff. I moved to New York and became a journalist because that was pretty much my only marketable skill. I was working at a pizza restaurant before that, so journalism was one step up from the pizza restaurant. And I started working at a place called Gawker, which was at one time a successful website, now dead, dead a few times over. I was writing different kinds of stuff at Gawker, a lot of stuff about basic questions, really just like, why is the world so messed up? Why do the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? You know, why do rich people run everything? The basic kind of questions that I think a lot of us ask ourselves. And over time, as I reported on all those questions, I found over and over again that they kind of led back to labor issues. You know, so I found myself sort of being drawn back to labor issues over and over again, and issues of like the decline of worker power. And that kind of drew me into being a labor reporter. I didn't really set out to be a labor reporter per se. The world drew me into it because that's where I found the answers to the questions I had. And in 2015, we unionized Gawker Media. It was the first online media company to unionize. The first of many. A lot of other media companies organized shortly after that, including Vice, where Kim was. And you know, the process of unionizing at Gawker gave me a chance to kind of see the labor movement from that side. You know, so I had been reporting on labor as a journalist, and then I also got to see it from the perspective of organizing my own workplace and subsequently getting involved in my union, in the Writers Guild. And as I got deeper and deeper into it from both sides, I started to see a lot of the problems with the labor movement. You know, it seemed to me so simple when I got involved in unions, you know, the feeling of like, wow, this is the tool that we need to fix all these problems we have. And it was like, you know, the veil is lifted and you're like, wow, this great tool exists. And all we got to do is give everybody unions and then the problems will be solved. And then, you know, going through the process of finding out all the reasons why it's broken and impossible to do, or I won't say impossible, the reasons why that has not been accomplished. And so over the years, I not only wrote about all types of labor issues and worker issues, you know, but I've also reported a lot on some of the flaws in organized labor itself and things that organized labor is not doing. So that was maybe the groundwork that I had going into the process of writing this book.
And you haven't only just done the research and talked to lots of people and done interviews. You helped organize a union. I feel like you left out a very big part of your lore here, because Hamilton, even if he won't admit it, he's kind of the reason, or the very least, one of the very first reasons that so much of digital media is organized, that Vice, my former workplace, organized, that Salon and Vox and all the other, I can't even remember half of them at this point. There's so many organized digital media workplaces. And Hamilton's really on the vanguard of that with our union, the Writers Guild of America East. And we both spent time on the council for that union. And when he was talking about kind of that moment when the veil lifted, when he saw maybe a little bit of how the sausage was being made, and I do wonder what your experience as an organizer and as a elected union official did to impact the way you view the issues and the strengths that the labor movement has.
Yeah, well, first of all, when we organized Gawker, you know, I was a writer. And really, I was a blogger. And so my job was just to like get up every morning and go on the internet and write like arguments. That's pretty much what I did. I was a professional arguer. And so like I didn't know anything about organizing. I was like the opposite of what an organizer should be. And the process of organizing Gawker Media, which was not just me, but a bunch of us, you know, did that work. That I learned a lot personally in that process, because I had never had to really engage with people in that way. You know, I was used to engaging people in like arguments, being like, here's what, you know, if I wanted us to have a union, I would have to like make an argument to you about why I was right that we need a union and like crush you and beat you into submission with that. And, you know, going through that organizing process, you sort of learn that, like, no, that's not how it is. You know, it's about listening to people and really trying to understand people and coming to consensus and all this stuff. So I learned a lot through that process. Getting involved with the union and being on the council of the union, which Kim and I both were for many years, that you know, you start to see some of the reasons why unions don't do all the stuff that you think they should do. Just to use an example that you know very well from our own union, we had a lot of success organizing online media companies for about 3 years. You know, one after the other, we were getting a lot of attention. I mean, people were writing stories about it left and right. It was a big thing in the labor movement. You know, the media was like this really hot organizing sector, and people were like knocking down the door of our union to join the union. It was really a wave of organizing. And then at a certain point, inside of our union, which was traditionally a screenwriters union, not a journalist union, so we were like the sort of the newcomers, people started being like, why are we doing all this organizing? Seems like there's a lot of new people around here. How much money are we spending on all this? And it turned into this big kind of internal battle, which had the effect of shutting down the organizing we were doing. It was, you know, we were too successful for our own good. And, you know, so seeing that kind of stuff, you start to understand some of the internal politics inside of unions that prevent them, and this happens on a national scale, you know, not just in one union, but in many unions, and also at the scale of like the AFL-CIO and on a national level, sort of these mechanisms that work against us being able to do what we need to do, which is to organize at the scale of millions and millions of people.
That's something I've always really appreciated about Hamilton's work. He is never afraid to call anyone on their BS, whether it's the AFL-CIO or really anybody. And I think that's a really valuable part of his approach to journalism, where he's like, no, this is something that impacts everyone. I don't care how you feel about it. I'm going to tell the truth. And it's hard to do. Like, I think I'm still a little too nice. Is it because you've just been doing this for long enough where you just really don't care about ruffling feathers? Like, and this is very much a complimentary thing. Like, I'm always so excited to see one of these new articles because I'm like, oh, who are we mad at now? It's great.
It's probably one of those, it's one of those qualities that it makes you like a bad human, but it's good in journalism, you know? So it's kind of like a mental illness in regular context, but it works okay if you're in journalism. But I do think, like, in the union world, you know, one thing you realize is, like, unions are this powerful tool that, you know, that we, you know, we went through the process of organizing and we lived it and we saw how much a union helped people, you know. After Gawker Media signed our union contract, the company got bankrupted immediately after that by a lawsuit. And we didn't lose our jobs, and we all kept our salaries because we had signed the union contract right before that, you know. And at Vice, when they organized, people got big raises, you know, life-changing raises. So we,
before they laid us all off,
we know, you know, you start to understand like how important it is, and what unions can offer people. And then you're like, well, okay, people deserve unions. You know, it's important that we help people get unions. And then you're like, whose responsibility is it to give everybody these unions? You know, and that's when I started to look at organizations like the AFL-CIO and some of the major unions. And you're like, why aren't you doing this work? You know, this work is important. We owe this to people. You know, there's nobody. I think a lot about the fact that, like, when we talk about reviving the labor movement, there is no, like, labor movement fairy that's going to fly in from outside to come down and organize 10 million people. Like, it's only us. Only unions as they exist today are the only people who are going to do it. So if you look at your union and they're not doing it, you get mad at them, or I get mad at them. So.
Very eloquently, though, yeah. At the very least. And before we dive deeper into his book, which is great, and you're clearly all going to buy a copy of it out there on your way out and get it signed.
And Kim's book.
Oh, yeah, I did one of those, too. No big deal. But, yeah, I want to talk just a little bit more about labor journalism, just because you, as one of our mutual friends is fond of saying, like, you've been doing it since before it was cool, as cool as any kind of journalism is. Like, I have no illusions here. But you've been reporting on labor and telling worker stories for a good while now. And I'm part of, I guess, a newer wave. There's been a pretty marked and I think obvious wave of newer reporters who are getting interested in labor journalism or in telling worker stories or just full on saying, I'm going to be a labor reporter. That wasn't really something that existed, what, like 10, 15, 20 years ago, the way that it does now. So I'd just love to get a little bit of your perspective on kind of what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's been a really good side effect of a lot of the unionization inside the media industry has been, you know, I didn't set out to be a labor reporter. I got into labor reporting because I was sort of interested in these big social and political issues, and I kind of got drawn into it. But a lot of people in our industry are just journalists who have gone through union drives in their own workplace, and that process of going through that has really opened their eyes to the importance of unions and the importance of labor issues. You know, there's literally thousands and thousands of reporters around the country who were just in a fight with their boss, you know, were just getting union busted, were just like personally went through all that stuff. And so you have definitely seen over the past 6, 7, 8 years, an increase in, I feel like, sort of the baseline visibility of labor issues in the mainstream media. I think as a direct result of people living this stuff and being like, this shit is important. And it's also drawn in, I feel like, people like you, I mean, who were sort of radical, you know, political type people already, and who had these experiences of getting involved with the labor movement, and who also understand how important this stuff is. So that has been, I think, a really good side effect, and has helped organized labor a lot, that new level of visibility. And, you know, the flip side of that is that now the industry is collapsing, is in the process of really laying off a lot of those reporters who've done that stuff for the past 6, 7, 8 years. And I think that level of attention is in danger because of some of the economic problems that the industry is suffering.
Well, since you brought it up, what are some ways that folks can support labor journalism and kind of ensure that it survives? Because without it, we're just going to go back to the business section, and no one cares what they have to say.
That's right. Labor journalism is the business section from the perspective of human beings, right? So it should be a standard thing. Yeah, for those of you who don't follow media industry news that closely, you know, essentially the economic model of ad-supported media, which has been the past century of American media, is being destroyed by Google and Facebook sucking all the money, all the ad money out of the media industry. So that's why you're seeing all these layoffs at all of these places, and all of these outlets are folding. Like, you cannot make the economics work thanks to these big tech platforms that are taking all the money. And so when we think about something like labor journalism, which really does have like some redeeming social value, and it has a lot of value to the labor movement itself, because if you're doing union drives and you're organizing workers and you're trying to, you know, if the boss is doing something illegal and you want visibility about that, you know, you need labor journalists to write about that stuff and to publicize it, or else it's really detrimental to unions themselves, if nothing else. So I do think, you know, if you want to see labor journalism exist at this point, it's very important that, like, you subscribe to In These Times, you subscribe to Jacobin, The Nation, like the places that do labor reporting, you subscribe to people's Substacks, maybe, you know? but like, big picture is like, the media is not the same as it used to be. It used to be you could consume all this news for free, and that era is over. And now, like, if you want something to be there, you should pay for it, or it's not going to be there.
That moves us to this more physical realm. Speaking of buying things and paying for things that are good for you in society, so you wrote a book. You wrote a book. Every little nerd's dream. I feel like we've been trading off like book schemes for years. Like, oh, I'm gonna write one. Like, I'm gonna write one. Someone will let us. We'll write one about cool labor stuff. And you pulled it off, and now it's out. What's it about?
I'm following your footsteps. First of all, Kim was the Fight Like Hell. I hope you all have bought that. The book is about, it's kind of about what I talked about, in the sense that I saw the potential of organized labor to fix the biggest underlying problems in America, which is essentially the rise of inequality. You know, there's a very famous chart that shows the decline of union density that goes like this. In the 1950s, at the height of union power, 1 in 3 workers in America was a union member. Today, it's 1 in 10. So that's the scale of the decline of organized labor power over the second half of the 20th century up to now. And at the same time, the rise of economic inequality, particularly since the Reagan era, has exploded. And so, you know, there's a chart that overlays those two things. Unions go down and inequality goes up, and it's very clear to see the relationship between those things. And I think that that rise of inequality is the big trend that is sort of driving a lot of the other political problems that we have, even things like the rise of Trump. You know, part of what you're seeing is like the death of the American dream. You can't have a one-income household and send your kids to college and buy a home and all this stuff. Like, all these promises are dead as a direct result of that rise of inequality. And, you know, there's two ways to fix inequality. One way is the government can do it through the tax code, and If you think that's going to happen, you're more optimistic than me. And the other way is workers get enough power to take back their share of the wealth. Like, that's really it. And so when I started to think about it like that, you're like, wow, unions are incredibly important. Like, that's the tool that workers use to take back their wealth. So they have this incredible potential to really fix the deepest problem in American society. And then at the same time, when you look at the reality of where organized labor is today, it's sort of this little niche that's declining, been declining for 50 years. It keeps declining. And so that, you know, that contrast is always like this tantalizing possibility and then this sort of disappointing reality was kind of the heart of the book. So I write about a lot of different aspects of the labor movement that I think are important. I write about some that are good examples, like a campaign to organize 40,000 childcare workers in California, 20-year-long organizing campaign. I talked to women whose mothers were there when the campaign started, and their mother retired, and the daughter went into childcare, and she was there when they finally finished it 20 years later. You know, so it's such a good example of like what's possible if unions stick with it. And I write about Unite Here, which is a great union that does a lot of work building political power through labor power, which I think is an important way to think about building political power and how they do that in Las Vegas and in other cities. And also write a chapter about, you know, one woman in West Virginia who decided she wanted to organize her fast food restaurant, Tudor's Biscuit World, and why she failed, you know, and why that task was so hard for her and sort of borderline impossible almost, why it's so hard for regular people to do these things. And throughout the book, I follow a great labor leader called Sarah Nelson, who is the head of the Association of Flight Attendants, very eloquent, fiery, radical union leader, and sort of write about her struggling with the idea of becoming a leader of the labor movement as a whole, you know, and thinking about how do you lead this movement that's kind of all over the place. And so that's not a very short and pithy description of the book, but basically the book's about how we can fix the labor movement so it can fix society.
Nice. Okay, lofty goal, casual for your first book, not the biggest lift. No, it's great. And I wanted to double down a little bit on your decision to follow Sarah. And I don't know if everyone knows Sarah Nelson. As he mentioned, very eloquent, fiery, very progressive and militant labor leader, like the kind of my kind of broad, you know, she's fun. And she's also very, I guess you'd say photogenic in a way that a lot of women are, and then they find themselves constantly underestimated or treated a certain way at work, you know? She's blonde, she knows how to do the wings, like, she's very much, she's like my big sister, I love her. And she's very much a different picture than this kind of avatar of what I think I grew up thinking of as like what a union leader is or what a union leader looks like. Like, I'm from a construction family in Jersey, so enough said, you know? And Sarah's journey's been so interesting because she is a very strong militant leader. She's very empathetic, very loving, and she's also been pitted against another woman in the labor movement who is right now leading the AFL-CIO. I think when you started working on the book, there was some chatter that maybe there'd be a challenge there. Mm-hmm. And that kind of brought up a lot of thinking with people about this almost existential, you know, two paths that labor could take if the head of the AFL-CIO was a more more risk-averse, more used to being part of a bureaucracy type person, mm-hmm. or Sarah.
Right.
And yeah, I would love to hear a little bit more about what you learned throughout that process of following her, and especially after it became clear that Sarah wasn't going to take that path.
Yeah. So Sarah Nelson first got kind of nationally famous in 2019 when the government shutdown was happening under Trump, and she came out and gave this speech that was like, we need to do a general strike to beat this government shutdown. And it was like, people were like, wow, because union leaders didn't give speeches like that, you know, in 2019. I mean, they gave speeches like that in 1930, but not recently. And she's, you know, she is a legitimate union leader. She is a president of an existing union in CWA. So She got it. That really elevated her profile nationally. She'd been a union activist for a long time, but you know, people started to think about the possibility of her becoming the president of the AFL-CIO, which is sort of theoretically the highest seat in organized labor. I mean, it very much depends what you do with it, because the AFL-CIO itself is this sort of big federation of unions, and it's very easy to get bogged down in bureaucracy running an institution like that. But on the other hand, when people started to think about what could somebody who was really radical and progressive do with a position like that, and think about reviving organizing and doing large-scale organizing and doing multi-union coalitions and organizing Amazon and, you know, big ideas in organized labor, a lot of that hope kind of got invested in Sarah Nelson and the idea that Sarah Nelson would run for president of the AFL-CIO. And the other candidate for that position was this woman, Liz Schuller, who is currently the AFL-CIO president. She was the number two at that time. She was kind of the in-house candidate, the insider that they were going to kind of usher in. And Sarah Nelson was kind of this, you know, outsider candidate dream of a lot of people. And
it's like a very 2016 kind of vibe.
Yeah,
overall,
it was very
right?
Bernie versus Biden type thing. And so I write about, you know, I started following her when that was still sort of an open question of whether she was going to really make a run for that. And I report on kind of what she went through, that eventually she decided not to do it, but you can read about that. But, you know, she's still out fighting a lot of big fights. And I do like to mention, you know, we talk about unions needing to organize 10 million people, for example, and some people kind of scoff at those numbers and think that those kind of numbers are too big, but she is president of a union with 50,000 members right now, and they are in the midst of an organizing campaign at Delta to organize 28,000 new flight attendants at Delta. So that's a one campaign that would grow the union by more than 50%, you know, so that's the kind of ambition that we need to see everywhere.
It makes sense that she's friends with Sean Fain from the UAW,
mm-hmm.
who is also, God, what a, I mean, not to kill your idols, obviously, but he's a heck of a union leader, too. Seems like the UAW is on a very smart and militant and also pragmatic upward trajectory that I think a lot of folks, even outside of the labor cinematic universe, have been noticing.
Yeah, it's important, I think, to have labor leaders in the public consciousness. You know, it's good that people know who Sean Fain is who don't really come to union talks. I mean, that's actually important. And you have to kind of think back to what Jimmy Hoffa or somebody to get to the point of being like, who's a labor leader that is known in the general public? And that is such a symptom of the decline of organized labor itself, you know, because I remember going and covering the AFL-CIO convention in 2017, the first time I went to it, and it was in St. Louis, and, you know, I walked in the press room, and in the press room was, like, one Bloomberg reporter and one, like, guy from a communist magazine, and that was it. And I was like, it's like this because people don't believe that unions are powerful. People don't believe that unions are important, you know, and that's something that has definitely changed since that time, because of, you know, in part leaders like Sarah Nelson, leaders like Sean Fain, you know, and now Sean Fain is sitting in the freaking State of the Union giving a thumbs up to Biden, which is a little freaky in its own way, but, you know, in the big picture, it is good for people to see union leaders just in society in general, because one of the hardest things about spreading union organizing is that people don't know anything about unions. And so just putting the idea that unions exist and can do stuff into the mind of the general public, I think, is really important.
Yeah, and there's so many places in this country where unions are not only this kind of unknown factor, they're actively encouraged against and propagandized against. I mean, one of your chapters in the book, you go to South Carolina, which is what they like proudly say were the least, like the most anti-union state in the nation. I think that's one of Nikki Haley's demonic catchphrases. Can you tell me just about, look, I've got a guillotine tattoo, what do you want? But yeah, if you could talk a little bit about your experience there and what you learned there, and also in places like Mississippi, and some of the other places that you traveled to and reported from. Mm-hmm. Like, you really went to places that don't have, like, Philly's a union town, New York is a union town, L.A., we know the spots, but what, there are people in Mississippi, in Alabama, and South Carolina that are giving everything they have to organize in this much more difficult climate. Could you just talk about what you came across, and I guess organizing in the South in general?
Yeah, organizing in the South has been like a rallying cry for the labor movement since 100 years ago, and there was a big thing called Operation Dixie in the 1940s after the CIO was founded, that they were gonna, they were this big plan to go organize the South, and they sent hundreds of organizers down there, and it kind of, they did some stuff, and then it sort of fell apart, and the South, the way to think about the South in the context of the labor movement is like, companies use the South the same way they use Mexico or the same way they use China. I mean, it's basically offshoring in our own country. They go down South to escape the power of unions and really to escape the power of any oversight, that any laws that would contribute to worker power, all that stuff. I mean, the South being an incredibly politically anti-union place, politically hostile, economically hostile, a huge pool of poor people. Companies prey on the desperation of workers down South, and it's obviously a horrible thing for those workers, first and foremost, but it's also a horrible thing for the power of the labor movement nationally, because you have this region of the country where companies can just flee to escape the power of organized labor. So there is a big, strategic reason to organize the South and to build up the power of unions in the South, above and beyond just wanting to help the people who need it. And so I have, and you have also done a lot of labor reporting down South, and it can be grim. And I wrote a chapter in my book about South Carolina because it is the state with the lowest union density in the United States of America, some under 3%, I think. And it thanks in part to people like Nikki Haley, who, I always laugh when they were like, she's the reasonable Republican, And meanwhile, you're like, I don't think so. Have you ever been to South Carolina? I don't think so. But, extremely hostile to unions. But this is true in almost every southern state now. Every state in the South is right to work. I've been to Mississippi a couple times, right? I covered a big UAW drive in Mississippi, and it's like when they try to organize, when they try to do a big organizing drive in any of those southern states, the governor comes out and essentially says to the workers, you're going to fuck up all what we, a good thing here, And there's a lot arrayed against these workers to be able to organize. And so in South Carolina, I wrote about these sort of little pockets of union power, like the Longshoremen Union, that is really an awesome and a strong union in Charleston. But statewide, it's pretty grim. And I always remember, like, I interviewed the head of the teachers union in South Carolina. And in a lot of red states, the teachers union is sort of one of the last sort of bastions of power for the Democratic Party and labor power that's politically involved. And in South Carolina, it was like they wouldn't even tell me how many members they had, because they were like, that might spark retaliation against our members. Like, they didn't even want anybody to know they were a member of the teachers union. Like, that is how harsh the climate was down there. And so it's important for all of us to, like, keep on reporting on the labor movement in the South and keep on encouraging unions to go down South and spend those resources, because there's still, I think you would agree, as someone who's been in Alabama a lot, there's still a little bit of a conventional wisdom in the union world that's like, this is, trying to organize down South is kind of like throwing money down a black hole. Like, we don't really want to do this. And in fact, it's one of the most important places to try to organize in America.
Yeah, and it's impossible to talk about organizing in the South without also talking about rural organizing. I've spent a lot of time reporting on coal miners and black lung disease in the coal fields of West Virginia. And when you mentioned that Tudor's Union Drive, I remember hearing about that and being like, oh, wow, like, a positive labor thing is happening in West Virginia. Hell yeah, like, it's 1921 all over again. And I want to hear more about what happened with that woman trying to organize in West Virginia. And how the risks that we take by assuming certain places don't want to organize or aren't worth organizing or are doing things against their own interests when things are often, if not always, much more complicated.
Yeah, I think she had, you know, it was such an interesting story in West Virginia because there's a lot of threads in the state of West Virginia that tell you about national trends that are going on. You know, West Virginia is like the prime example of a state, for one thing, that used to be a blue state. And why was it a blue state? It was a blue state because it was heavily unionized, thanks to the United Mine Workers. You know, it was a blue state way longer than a lot of other rural states in the same region, you know, that all went Republican. It hung on because it had that strong union history. And when they eventually sort of broke that union power in West Virginia, it became, you know, one of the most pro-Trump states in America. And it's all directly tied to the decline of that union power, as well as the decline of the standard of living in West Virginia. So this lady, Cynthia Nicholson, her dad was a union member. She grew up around unions, which is the case with a lot of people in West Virginia. There's such a strong union culture in that state, more than a lot of other places. And so she was working at this fast food job at a biscuit restaurant and was just like, this place sucks, the manager is horrible, like they're not paying us right, you know, we need a union. She knew, you know, she is an example of somebody who knew what unions could do thanks to the way she grew up, and had that thought, which is such an important first step that doesn't happen in a lot of places. And she, you know, she called up her husband's old union that was like the operating engineers, and they were like, what the hell? Like, there's no engineers. And but eventually she found a union organizer who agreed to help them. And, you know, she went into a restaurant and they got a majority of union cards signed, and they sort of had this real grassroots up from nowhere campaign. And then, you know, as happens in so many places, once they filed for that union election, the union busting started and the company started sending in all these outside managers, and they started promising things to some people and they started making threats to other people, and they're all in this really tiny little town, so everybody knows everybody and the neighbors are threatening people, and it got very dirty and nasty, and they end up losing that election. But it's such an example of like all of these big factors that have driven the decline of unions kind of were embodied in this one little fast food restaurant. And, you know, one of the most interesting things about that campaign to me is like, she's just this lady who was like, we should have a union here, this job sucks. But when they filed for that election, that was maybe the only fast food restaurant in America that had filed for a union election at that time. So like, that's how rare it is. It's incredible how rare it is. And it just really came from this one person's hard work.
Sometimes that's all it takes.
Yeah.
Were there any, so one of the things that I came across when I was writing my book, which is like even bigger than this, like, and when I turned it in, I think I went 20,000 words over the word count because I was left to my own devices for a year and it was early COVID. But one thing that killed me when I was finally, you know, turning in my manuscript, having it torn from my clawed hands, was there was so much that I couldn't fit, that so many people and stories and moments I had to leave out. And I doubt I am alone in feeling that very bad feeling. What did you have to leave out? Like, what are you going to stick back in there for the reprinting when it sells out?
We're very different because I, you know, we're not getting paid by the word here. I'm trying to finish this thing.
That's the difference between reported and history.
I'm trying to finish that book. I mean, I will say, like, you know, my book is really just little tastes of things in the labor movement, you know, and you know this as a labor reporter. It's like for every story that you write or I write, there's at least 10 other stories that I don't write that are equally interesting and important and meaningful and inspiring. There's just not the bandwidth to cover all this stuff, you know, but as far as I'm concerned, like every union drive is newsworthy. You know, every act of union busting is newsworthy. You know, every state has such interesting stories. I mean, you can go anywhere, really, and sort of dig into these. You can go to Iowa and go to some little union local and hear this entire history of the 20th century, you know, unspool through the eyes of, like, of how it's played out inside these unions. You know, I wrote a chapter in the book about Nabisco workers in Portland, Oregon, who went on strike. And sort of the chapter is kind of about the reality of a strike, you know, but it also talks about the backstory of that union, which is a sort of rare factory workers union that has been able to maintain a middle class lifestyle by maintaining this union power. You know, and they can talk for hours about every contract fight that they've had, you know, what they had to do to maintain every single benefit that they've won, fighting against multinational corporations, you know, like they, you could write an encyclopedia about this one union and multiply that by thousands and thousands of unions all over the country. So everybody should be a labor reporter. There's plenty of stories out there for everybody. Yeah.
Like I like to say, every story is a labor story, right? There's always a labor angle, mm-hmm. which is what makes it so much fun and so interesting to do this job and also so heartbreaking. Because like you said, there's for every email you get where you're like, oh, I should check that out. There's mm-hmm. like 30 more that day where you're like, I should also check that out and that out and that out and that out. And there's six other labor reporters in the country. Maybe I'll forward it to this one, yeah. you know? But that is the state of labor media, and it's better than it was 5 years ago. So, you know, at least you're out here. You're still reporting, too. Like, you've worked on this book. It's out, but you're still, like, you just had a new cover story come out.
We got to earn a living out here. And you also, we both have stories in the current issue of In These Times magazine. So I hope you should all read In These Times magazine. And by the way, free subscription to In These Times for any union member in America gets a free subscription to In These Times. Look it up, Google it. All you got to do is fill it out. You get a free subscription, so there's no reason not to get it.
Here you go. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we should plug while we're up here, right? I feel like we've gone down a pretty good list.
We can. Hi, thanks for coming. As a South Carolinian, I would say you got it right. I'm thinking about all kinds of stuff, but I guess a question that brings it all together is what either tools do unions have or what success stories might you have for the problem of bringing in a bunch of new people? So 20-some thousand flight attendants in Philadelphia, culture workers all over are coming into sort of consciousness of themselves as labor organizers, labor workers. Operation Dixie seems like a very terrible name for a transracial, you know, so like how do unions bring in groups of disparate people?
Yeah, it can definitely be, there can be a culture clash issue inside unions, obviously. I mean, I think the answer is like, well-run unions are democracies. And it's, I mean, this is kind of a bad answer, but it's sort of an attitude problem. I mean, to me, if you're inside a union and you're like, all these new people are here, get the hell out. Like, you're an asshole. I mean, what's your problem? You know, like, you should fundamentally should not look at it that way. And we, you know, this is the fight we had in our own union. So, like, but, you know, look at a union like UAW or many other unions. UAW has, you know, a bazillion grad students in it now that have nothing to do with auto workers. But you have to kind of be enlightened enough to realize that, A, the union is stronger by growing. I mean, there's no union that gets weaker by growth, you know. So you have to approach it that way and be like, growth is the mandate, both because everybody deserves a union and because the labor movement, union density has been going down. If we don't turn around, we're going to die. So, like, growth before everything, and we all have to be a little gracious about welcoming those people in the same way, you know, if there was refugees who washed up on the shore, you'd be like, welcome to America, hopefully. Same kind of thing.
Yeah, and there's so much historical precedent for that, too. I mean, there's always been this sort of craft mentality of we're going to look out for our guys and only our guys specifically. Mm-hmm. And then there's the more industrial way of thinking of it where we're like, oh, we want everyone to be in a union, so let's do that. Let's mix it up. Let's bring in all kinds of people. I mean, it's not just the IWW. It's even going, thinking back to like jokes like in The Simpsons, there's the, what, Homer's in like the jazz dancers, nuclear engineers, and like some other thing union. Like, it sounds wacky, but there's, I mean, look at the UAW or CWA. There's all kinds of wild professions and all kinds of big unions, and it works because they want it to work and we need it to work. Yeah, just don't be an asshole.
Yeah, basically.
Hi, so I feel like I'm losing my mind because Dartmouth just, their men's basketball team, just they had an election, they're unionized with the SEIU, and it feels blank. I'm like, why is there not an organizer on the campus of every Power Five school in America right now, going 24 hours? You want to talk about getting people in the South to think about unions, go to the campus of Alabama and start explaining to them why these, you know, why these football players need to be in one. Better yet, get some of those football players explaining to them why they need to be in one. I'm just kind of curious, maybe this is something either you know about, but am I missing something, or is this just like a huge missed opportunity?
I think you're famous sports journalist, Tim Marchman, I think. I totally agree with you. I've written this story, by the way. I've shockingly, my story in these times didn't fix the problem, but but I completely agree with you, particularly as you touched on in the South, where you're like, if you could organize SEC football teams, man, that is overnight one of the strongest political forces in the state of Alabama is the union of the Alabama football team. And that's not a joke. I mean, that's real. Like, there is a ton of latent power in those young people's hands if they were able to unionize. So, yeah, I think it should be a big priority for organized labor. Just, you know, the amount of cultural power and economic power that would go with that is huge. And the Dartmouth campaign that you mentioned, which was the first kind of successful union vote that just happened, you know, that just kind of happened because, like, one guy on the team sort of asked somebody about it. Like, it wasn't even a strategic thing from above. It just sort of happened. So, yes, there should be tons of people organizing college athletes right now.
I feel like you could turn Texas blue if you just organized half of your team.
Longhorns, yeah.
So I know you've written an article about this, so I kind of know how you're going to answer already. But what do you do, since I'm in this position, what do you do if you're already in a union and that union sucks? It's not democratic at all. There's so many layers to the bureaucracy. I'm in a district in Philadelphia. The locals run out of New York. It's part of a larger blanket organization across the country.
Yeah.
And there's like none of the decisions that I've seen my local made are democratic at all.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't go to the website and see a vote count of our last contract. There is no vote count. There was no vote. They just pushed it through.
Yeah, it's sadly a pretty common situation. A lot of unions are not democratically run. I mean, I think, like, you know, the hard answer is like organize to change it, which is kind of unsatisfactory because Teamsters for a Democratic Union took 40 years or so to do it. So on the other hand, the UAW, well, look, you know, it's never a bad time to start. I mean, I'm not sure what union you're in, but, you know, the Teamsters did it, and they were organized a caucus for reform, and they fucking stuck around for decades, and they finally won. The UAW did it. Faster than that, you know, just a few years. UAW for Democracy, they got Sean Fain elected. Now look at everything. The payoff from that is incredible, you know. So it comes down to, and I wrote a story in These Times magazine just this month about UFCW and the people that are trying to do that very same thing inside UFCW. So, I mean, I get, you know, the answer is like find like-minded people and start organizing a caucus to reform the union. And it's not an easy path, and it's not an overnight path, but that's the best answer I have. What do you think?
It's so terrible that the best and most pragmatic answer to almost any labor question is more meetings.
Yeah.
But, like, that's the answer.
Sadly, yes.
I was curious what your thoughts were on building labor power in industries that are increasingly freelance, contingent, gig work, where often it's like also not technically legal to organize in some cases. Like, what can you do?
It's a good question. It's really hard because, as you know, in the United States of America, freelancers cannot legally unionize, or independent contractors cannot legally unionize, which is the exact reason why the gig economy has grown so fast and why companies are so excited about pushing people into the category of independent contractors, because you therefore lose your ability to collectively bargain or really organize and you know, you lose your access to a whole slew of labor rights. And so it's hard, you know, because of, you know, that bad set of laws combined with a very, very intense push by companies of all types. You know, I mean, we think about Uber and, you know, you think about Uber and Lyft and stuff like that as the classic, like, gig economy. But really, it's every industry. Every industry is very enthusiastic about pushing people off the roles of full-time employment. College professors, you know, how many tenure-track jobs are left? No, everybody's an adjunct now. Like, every industry across the board is trying to do this. So it does make it very hard to access the classic type of union power that we think of like holding an election and forming a union. I mean, I think the answer again, which is, you know, not the most satisfactory answer in the world, but is like, they can't stop you from organizing, you know? And of course there are a lot of groups, Gig Workers United and other groups. There's a lot of organizing of Uber drivers and drivers like that that has happened. And in some places, you know, they've successfully essentially run political campaigns to get rights for those classes of workers rather than classic union drives, you know? So it becomes a matter of sort of getting the laws changed to give those classes of workers power on the state level. depends how hostile of a state you're in. But I mean, I guess the baseline answer is like, whenever the laws are against you, it just comes down to organizing with other workers, and like at the heart of all labor power is the fact that you can withhold your labor. You know, that is the kernel of all labor power, whether you're in a union or not. And so, you know, keep that in mind. And like, if you can build to a point where you can have a group of workers who can choose to withhold their labor, you do have power, even if you can't unionize.
Yeah, and especially since I know you, Emily Friedlander, an esteemed culture journalist, have a vested interest in this, because we are all independent contractors. I'll just say there have been examples of, especially in journalism, because so many of us get laid off all the time, like clockwork, and a lot of us go freelance because, like, what else are you going to do? there have been efforts like the Freelance Solidarity Project, the IWW has a freelance journalist union, but there has been some very concrete progress with legislation in at least, I think, New York City and California. That's AB5, that's different. But there has been some legislation passed to try and make it better for freelancers, like ensuring that we get paid, which is occasionally a nice thing to have. Or, like, so it's given us some rights, but that's statewide legislation. So maybe we should talk to my friends at the Philly AFL-CIO and see if we can get a PA one, you know, and talk to our friends in Delaware and Connecticut, Baltimore. Like, once again, more meetings.
Yeah. The labor laws, of course, are terrible. And they've been terrible for ever, really, since the beginning of the country. Sometimes a little better, sometimes a little worse. True. But, you know, they were throwing people in jail in the 1800s for striking. Right. And I don't know. I hear a lot of people talking about how we need to change the laws. And sure, it'd be nice if the laws weren't so terrible. But I look at the Supreme Court ruling that all public employees are right to work regardless of the state law. And I don't know that they wouldn't determine that, you know, employers have a God-given right to exploit workers regardless. I look at Unite here in Las Vegas. It's a right-to-work state, mm-hmm. and they have power. I look at Florida, which has just passed this law where if the union doesn't have 60% of the people paying dues directly, because they've mm-hmm. outlawed dues checkoff for public employees. And I hear unions, there was a radio report on this a couple weeks ago, and the unions were talking about how we just have to give up. They've mm-hmm. outlawed the union. And I don't see how they expect to win anything if they're just going to walk away because the bosses don't like them.
Look, I totally agree with you. And, you know, I think one of the points I try to make in this book is exactly what you said, which is, you know, that is what most labor leaders say when you ask them about the decline of unions. They'll be like, the laws, the laws, the laws. Fine, you know, we're always going to have bad, like, you know, we live under capitalism, like, they're always going to be fighting us, and the laws are always going to be bad. So, I mean, we're always going to be trying to improve labor law, but Taft Hartley Act was passed in 1947. That was the most recent bad set of labor laws. It's been 75 years and we haven't changed it. We haven't repealed it. So like when at some point you have to be like, this is not the strategy to be like, as soon as we repeal this, we'll be able to organize. Been 75 years. And the fact is that there is a lot of low hanging fruit for unions to organize today that you don't need to change the law for. You know, there is tons of opportunity for union organizing all over the place that does not require any change of laws. Obviously, it would be easier if right to work laws didn't exist. But as you say, there's tons of examples in right to work states where there are unions with power. So like, it's more to me, a lack of enthusiasm from the institutions of organized labor to really pursue organizing at a large scale. All right,
thanks. Thanks for the talk, thanks for the book. At the beginning, you said that you sort of trace a lot or all of the problems in this country back to inequality. And I think last September, I would have been like, yep, totally. And since October, I feel like the left has been going through a massive reconfiguration with the genocide in Gaza, and like all of this stuff is coming into perspective and focus around imperialism. And I'm curious, as a labor journalist, how you're making sense of that shift in the left, and if you're going through some of your own sort of thinking about how does this fit into the bigger politic.
Yeah. Well, let me not say that all problems are inequality, because I would sound like a moron if I said that. I mean, I think that's sort of an overarching big problem. It's not obviously not the only problem that America faces, especially with our history. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to say about Gaza. I mean, there's a lot of unions have actually come together for a ceasefire. There's a big group of really powerful unions that have come together under the banner of Labor for a Ceasefire. That's actually kind of encouraging how much of the labor movement has now come under that banner. I think maybe in the bigger sense, like, you know, internationalism and thinking internationally is you know, an evolution of the same kind of thinking that you know, you have at the workplace when you go from just being like, this is my job, to being like, this is all of our job, and we're in this together, and we need to act in solidarity. You know, that is the same type of thinking that you then can trace up to your state, to your country, and then to international issues. And I think that people who get involved in the labor movement are kind of setting themselves down that path to starting to think about international solidarity. You know, the reality of labor history in America is not a very good track record of groups like the AFL-CIO. When you look at what they've done internationally, not great. But I think at the grassroots level and at the level of people who are union members and who are in the labor movement, I think that the same values that the labor movement gives you will take you to a place where you start to understand those problems internationally. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you, the Free Library. Thank you, Kim Kelly.
Thank you, Hamilton.
And we'll sign books upstairs.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.